All right, then. Welcome aboard. Time for a new edition of American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. With me, my lovely wife, co-host, Heidi Morales Ryan.
I like the way you gave me this show of hand.
It's as if we're on film. And we do this
radio
every...
Radio on the TV.
That's right. We do this every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6. I'm sure you are aware, if you're a regular listener, that we call our show How Music Changed on Fridays, wherein we look at a specific topic that we consider to be one of the 250 most important in the history of recorded music. And we discuss them in depth. So we've been discussing Stax now for 19 shows. Actually, this is number 20 in our series dedicated to Stax. This will find us right now at the tail end of 1971. I would say from the fall. We start in September of 1971 with this show. And we'll get in as much as we can. The first track up that I want to play is somebody that you probably never heard of. His name is Eddie Giles. He was new to the label. He's a guy from Shreveport, Louisiana. He recorded this song earlier on another label, had a slight regional hit with it. They figured they'd be able to duplicate the success by slicking it up a little bit, giving it like the Stax treatment.
Right.
That didn't quite happen, but it's still a pretty cool song. I liked it. I like the groove of this. So here's Eddie Giles singing Losing Boy. Losing Boy. I hate when I can take a song title. Well, I kind of like it because I do it all the time. But when you can apply a song title to the fate of the song.
Oh, it's such a sad thing. Oopsie.
In this instance, absolutely yes. It was, he was a losing boy. No respect on that track. One thing worth noting, though, is the tempo of the song. You'll notice it was fairly upbeat. And it was around this time, in like 1971, when an awful lot of R&B music was sort of like beginning to get upbeat. It was beginning to move toward like a disco sort of a thing. And it was becoming very popular as opposed to where it was. It was obviously a little bit funkier back in the 60s. Things were a little bit slower, but the groove was picking up a little bit. And that's what was happening with this next artist and their song. It was written by Mac Rice, who wrote an awful lot of material for Stax. And he wrote this thing with an upbeat feel, very similar to the song we just heard. That was more or less where he heard it. And it was decided after the song was being played in demo form by a number of people at Stax that you really ought to give this song to the Staple Singers, because topically, it was exactly what the Staples were about.
Very cool.
The song was basically came about as out of a conversation that Mac Rice was having with Luther Ingram at the time, where Luther Ingram had said something like, you know, black folk need to learn to respect themselves.
Wow. Just that simple, huh?
Just that simple. And Mac Rice said, whoa, I'm going to run with that. So he wrote the song, and it was, like I said, a fairly up-tempo composition. And he really preferred to keep it that way. But now it's in the hands of producers who take the demo and the Staple Singers to Muscle Shoals, where a lot of the tracks are being recorded there. And there, in the hands of drummer Roger Hawkins and Barry Beckett and the producers, the song begins to slow down. It begins to get this really slinky groove that everybody in the studio is tripping on. Mavis
wow.
is freaking out. Mavis
That's
is
so
loving
cool.
it. She says this is the best thing that she ever recorded in her life. She loved every second of this. The funny thing is, when Mac Rice heard their final version of it, he said, "You done ruined my song." Like, what'd you do? You know,
what?
He just figured that they destroyed it by changing the tempo and the rhythmic feel. He felt that they took it away from what could have been a potential hit because it wasn't upbeat anymore. It kind of like went in the wrong direction for a pop song in his mind. Well, he's changed his mind since then.
I'm sure he has.
Since the song went number 12 on the pop charts, I think it made all the difference in the world about what he considered to be what would or would not be popular. Here is what might be the best thing ever recorded by the Staple Singers. One of my favorite Mavis performances ever. Respect Yourself.
Oh,
tracks like that where you can't stop covering the history of Stax right after Otis Redding dies. You know,
this is true.
It just, although a lot of this stuff that is in this part of the show could have just as easily been done to a show dedicated to Muscle Shoals, which is something that I would really love to do, is a show based upon what was happening at Fame Studios and in Muscle Shoals. And if we do that show, I'm not saying we definitely will or definitely won't, because it depends on how much of that stuff gets covered. But if there's things that land exclusively in that field, we might have to do it, which means there might be some redundancy. I don't think I'll have any problem playing that song twice, though. Just one of my favorite songs of all time. Now, there's an awful lot of artists at this point in time on the label that are relatively obscure. This next one is a band called Hot Sauce. Although they're not really a band. They got signed to a recording deal as a threesome. Three, I think, all female vocalists. And before they even got into the studio, two of them backed out, which really obviously left the name, but only one vocalist, which her name was Rhonda Washington. And this is the first track that was recorded under the name Hot Sauce. No real chart damage was done by this song, but I get a great kick out of the lyrical content of the track. It's called I'll Kill a Brick About My Man. But it cracks me up. I'll kill a brick about my man. Credited to Hot Sauce.
I'm sure the word was another B word originally.
Maybe. Never thought of that. Well, there you go. It might be a matter of, you know, swapping out what's appropriate.
Who right.
Well, you know, for a lot of these shows, I've been reading an awful lot of excerpts from a book called Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion, written by Robert Gordon. It's been immensely helpful to me in this series. But the past three or four shows, I wasn't using it quite as much because there was, like, I guess, more songs than history in terms of what the book was providing with what was happening. But I have a few excerpts here that need to be read before we play our next track. So If it sounds a little bit rough at times, it's because I'm reading excerpts. I'm not reading, you know, entire pages.
It's not fluid.
Exactly. So that's not the writer. That's me with my excerpts.
We'll forgive you.
When MGM was designing its African-American pitch for Shaft, it reached out to Stax. Isaac Hayes recalls MGM's concept, a movie targeted at the black consumer market to have a black director, black leading actor, black editor, black composer, and I was asked to do the music.
Wow.
Isaac came back to the people at Stax and goes, I got a surprise for y'all. We're going to do a soundtrack to this movie. Everybody went, wow. But we have no clue of what the procedure is going to be. Lester Snell, the keyboardist, remembers that the next question by everybody was, how much will we get paid?
Uh-oh.
Hayes was ready for the challenge. Soundtracks worked toward his strength, music and drama. He'd not need a lyricist. He told Willie to note the tempo of the characters walking. He said, I want you to play 16ths on the hi-hat to that tempo, Willie continues. So they rolled the machine over to me, and I play the hi-hat. The tempo of his steps is where we got the tempo of the song from. Hall begins making the cymbal sounds, the classic cymbal sounds that open the Shaft theme song.
Awesome.
When the recording dates arrived, it was a collision of cultures. They set aside 4 days for us, Isaac explains. The first 2 days was for the rhythm, the third was for the sweetening, horns, strings, all the miscellaneous instruments, and the fourth day was for vocals. So we walked on the soundstage. They had our music stands set up and everything. We're getting comfortable, and the engineer said, where are your charts? What charts? We ain't got no charts, man. You don't have charts. I saw the terror in this man's eyes.
Surprise.
I said, just roll the film, man. Everybody had their own little private notes that they'd written down. This is head arranging at its finest.
Show 'em.
Guy rolled the film. The swipe went across the screen. The first music cue came. Bam! We hit it. I called next. We played reel after reel. Next cue. Next cue, and we knocked them out.
That freaked them out.
Amazing. That first day, we finished 1 hour and 10 minutes ahead of schedule and had done both days of work.
Crazy.
The engineer said, I have to tell you guys, I thought this was going to be a disaster. How do you guys remember all the words with no charts? Remember all that with no charts, excuse me. Said, we work in a studio, man. We've been doing this stuff for years.
Surprise.
On the third and final day, Isaac was being driven to work with his 3 beautiful backup singers. And much as he wanted to concentrate on them, he was distracted. He'd just learned that for a song to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Song, it needed lyrics.
Uh-oh.
So we soaked in their vibe as he jotted the song's conversational lyrics on a piece of paper. Not quite done, even as he entered the lot.
Wow.
Who is the man? I'm just talking about Shaft. Most of it literally ad-libbed on the spot because
crazy.
He was inspired by the sexiness of his background singers when he wanted to talk about this black dick who's a sex machine to all the chicks.
Wow.
Here's Isaac Hayes with the theme from Shaft. Thank you.
that private dick. That's a sex machine to all the cheeks. You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Shot. Right on. You see, this cat Chef is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Chef?
Well, we can do it.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Chef.
Still amazing to this day.
Hard
amazing
to believe.
Piece of music.
Probably one of the most memorable themes ever.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, I mean, for a head arrangement, usually head arrangements revolve around songs with relatively straightforward tempos and rhythms so
right.
that they don't really break a 4-4 pattern or
okay.
at least a straight, even cadence.
Sure.
And that song has got all these little odd bits and tricks and stuff
yeah.
that shift it out of a standard pattern that could have messed up anybody without a chart. To think that was done as a head arrangement blows my mind, really.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible. Well, back to the book. Soon, he'd be setting new records as the Shaft album, released with the movie in July of 1971, became the most successful album in a string of highly successful releases. It won 3 Grammy Awards and took home an Oscar for Best Music Original Song.
Not surprising.
Right. The album, the double album, became Stax's best-selling album ever and helped the film recoup more than 26 times its investment.
Wow.
At the Academy Awards ceremony, Isaac, a ladies' man, sex symbol, and now pop star, brought as his date the woman who was the most significant in his life, his grandmother who had raised him.
Aw.
He performed the theme song on the telecast and then returned to her side to await the inevitable award announcement. The song was so successful that, in a way, it eventually led to more or less the downfall of both Isaac Hayes and Stax. The amount of hubris that was developing on the heels of it would eventually be the thing that basically caused the label some grief as we move forward. But we can get to that when the time comes. Meanwhile, more music from this exact era, as we said, the late summer into the end of 1971. Rufus Thomas had been amazingly lucky with, and successful is maybe just a more honest word, because he deserved it. Coming back the way that he did after being more or less, you know, shunted aside by the label for more contemporary acts, he ends up becoming one of their biggest moneymakers by doing dance tracks, you know, dance craze songs.
Right.
We played one last week. But at this point, this is where it becomes absurd. This is just...
Even you have to draw the line, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I've got to play this track solely because it's so incredibly ridiculous. Rufus Thomas singing Do the Funky Penguin.
Shuffle your feet when you do the funky penguin. to the right. Get so good to your baby, you can do it all night. Everybody doing it, it's all over town. You can't mess around, got to get on down. Do the fucking penguin, do it right now. Do the fucking penguin, do it right now. Corns on your feet, kick off your shoes.
Song's not quite as ridiculous as the title or the theme, but it's ridiculous nonetheless.
I love that photo in that book there with them wearing the costume.
Yeah, he actually dressed up in like essentially like a penguin suit, literally.
I
like
only regret that I never got to see that stage show.
Oh my. Rufus Thomas. Meanwhile, his daughter, Carlos, this is pretty much where we say goodbye to her, at least as far as having any sort of significance on the charts.
Oh,
she started with her dad as being really one of the first artists on the label. And it's at this point, this is the very last song that she would have any sort of chart record
position
at all. It stopped at number 49 on the R&B charts, went nowhere near the pop charts. And out of respect to Carla for having so much to do for the label, I think we ought to play this track. It's called You've Got a Cushion to Fall On.
Good evening, dear. Do you feel okay? How are things on the job today? Sit right down and kick off your shoes. Supper will be ready in a minute or two. I can tell your promotion didn't go through, and I can see it's got you feeling sad and blue. Come on now, let me see you smile. Looking down really ain't your style. Now how's about a nice evening kiss? Things can't be as bad as this. I know you built your hopes up high, and you got shot down. Like a bird in the sky.
Carla Thomas, easily one of the most respected female vocalists from the Stax label, especially from the people who worked there. Everybody loved Carla, but her story just eventually she just faded away with song after song after song. There was about 12 in a row that didn't chart.
She has a beautiful voice.
Yeah, she was a great singer, and she had a good feel for what she was doing. It just never really found a spark back in the commercial market. This next band certainly did. With our previous show, we played their track, What You See Is What You Get.
Oh, yeah.
That was the Dramatics, of course. And that was another song that was more or less like I was talking about. How around this time, R&B music was beginning to get a little bit more up-tempo. And mm-hmm. That's a good example of what I was talking about. This one as well. I mean, you can just hear how it's beginning. It's not quite disco yet, but it's setting it up in a way. It's like it's beginning to suggest that sort of a thing.
That groove.
That steady groove. So this has got that up-tempo feel. It's crazy string part, too, which is another thing that was very important to disco, is you have to have like a really good imaginative string section that more or less became your hook.
Right.
So here's Stax, which was known for its horns, now more or less showing its weight with what it's able to do with string arrangements.
Cool.
And the thing that made this track cool, very much like what made What You See Is What You Get cool, is the way that they pass around the vocals from band member to band member. It gave it a sense of excitement, and it became a number 16 R&B hit for the Dramatics. Here's the track. It's called Get Up and Get Down. Dramatics, a band that I think is sorely underrated.
Yeah, they found their groove.
You know, like when you look back at like the stuff, I mean, everybody seems to remember the Staple Singers and Isaac Hayes from around this era, which is, of course, appropriate.
Those songs are fantastic. Of course.
Yeah. But the Dramatics, to me, have their share of like really awesome, great, well-produced tracks. What you see is what you get. Stunning, you know.
And, one of my faves.
And that's a pretty darn good one there as well. Another band, I mean, the Barquets, we haven't spoken about them for how many shows now. They go all the way back to pretty much.
One of my favorite bands.
Yeah?
Yeah, sure.
They go all the way back to the Otis era. But they ended up eventually getting recruited. Isaac Hayes was using them a lot and everything else. And they were trying to basically get back on the charts on their own. But it's been a four-year dry spell for them until Isaac Hayes' song gave them the ability or the inspiration to basically do something of their own. An awful lot of what the Barquets would do is they would grab material that other people had did and reinvent it in their own likeness, so to speak. So their albums sort of sounded like a really weird radio station gone through some like cool convoluted, surreal rearranging of the songs that you know. That's exactly what was going on here. They actually took Isaac Hayes' hit, called it Son of Shaft, and ended up with a number 10 R&B hit, 53 on the pop charts. Here's the Barquets, Son of Shaft.
I'm the son of a bitch!
You know, it's an amazing fact. Isaac Hayes' name appears nowhere on the songwriting credits for that song.
Really?
Yeah. He must have been very kind to just let it go.
Right.
Because obviously, it's 100% lifted. I mean, there's almost
You know,
they wrote a couple of words. That's, you know, it's kind of funny. All right, then. I'm going to go back.
You can have that one, kids.
Yeah, I'll go. Throw your bone. Go on. Reading again a little bit of history from that book I'm talking about, Respect Yourself, Stax Records and the Soul Explosion. Great book written by Robert Gordon. Some of the history of the label. On the home front, a new problem had arisen. Deutsche Grammophon, which owned a piece of Stax, was so enjoying its taste of popular music that it wanted more.
Uh-oh.
In mid-1971, the label purchased James Brown's recording contract and back catalog. Between James Brown and Stax, all they saw was hits and high sales, so they instigated an expansion of their own label, Polydor. They began to want to exercise some influence on us and on our business decisions, says Al. And the discussions arose once again about us consolidating our distribution. Stax had an interconnected web of independent distributors that Deutsche Grammophon saw as a peculiar and clunky arrangement. Despite the setup's obvious success, Deutsche Grammophon wanted to align Stax with a corporate distributor. While a corporate distributor might help Al get into the chains that he sought, he feared losing the control he currently had. Putting Deutsche Grammophon between himself and the product delivery created too great a distance. The relationship, says Al, grew uncomfortable. I told them that we wanted out of the deal, Al continues, and they were irritated by that. The audacity, you little old fella from Memphis, backwater Tennessee. Phillips, who owned Deutsche Grammophon, controlled the sockets and the light that the light bulbs went in and the energy throughout your home, so who do you think you are? Extended conversations ensued. Somewhere in there, I may have become an irritant because of my persistence. And finally, Al was given a number. It would cost $4.8 million to buy back Deutsche Grammophon's equity in Stax. Nearly half of that came from cash that we had in the bank, and the other came from a $2.5 million loan from Union Planters Bank, says Al. Union Planters National Bank had helped them buy back their stock from Gulf and Western. Payoff had gone very smoothly, ahead of schedule even, so acquiring the new loan was easy.
Wow.
The deal was settled that cool November of 1971 in the back bungalow of the Beverly Bills Hotel. I walked rather proudly through the Polo Lounge, says Al, and on back to the bungalows, and I politely put that cashier's check on the table and closed that deal with the gentleman, freeing us from the international distribution as well as purchasing back their equity interest in the company. Stax's 1971 gross income, according to court documents, was just short of $17 million. That's a heap of sales, accumulated at wholesale rates of about 50 cents per single and $2.50 for albums.
Wow.
Stax was, for the first time since it had become a national concern, entirely independent, able to determine its destiny, keep its profits, set its own course. Here's a track credited to L.V. Johnson. Didn't do very much else for the label, but it's called Don't You Mess With My Money, My Honey, or My Woman.
Share my happiness, come on in. Share my fun. I don't share my baby love with anyone. You know we've been friends such a mighty long time. We live by the rule. What's yours is mine. You know we share so many things together. Cigarettes and my whiskey, that didn't matter. I've always treated you like a brother, but since I found this new love, I can't let you go no further.
Don't you mess with my money, my honey.
credited to L.V. Johnson. That track is Don't You Mess With My Money, My Honey, or My Woman.
A little confusing for me, but...
Probably had something to do with why it wasn't a big hit. But a cool groove. A cool groove.
Yes.
You probably never heard of this next artist either. His name is Eric Mercury. Started his career in Toronto. Lived there for quite a while. Eventually moved it to New York in the late 60s, where not much was happening there either. So he came down to Memphis to try his luck down there. In the meanwhile, you know, Steve Cropper, who was pretty much one of the most important people in Stax Records for his guitar playing, member of the MGs, his songwriting, his arranging, his production work. He did so much there. It was such a sad thing when he left. It was the loss of him and Booker T are probably the single most important in terms of personality.
You could feel the nails in the coffin going in.
Well, at least that sound of what it used to be.
Right.
Well, now he's got his own facility. He's called a TMI, so he was recording, and he came across Eric Mercury. So he picked him up to record him, and under the auspices of Steve Cropper helping him, they released an album with what I consider to be one of the most really genuinely funny album titles of all time. It's called Funky Sounds Nurtured in the Fertile Soil of Memphis, That Smell of Rock.
Interesting. What kind of rock?
All right, then. The single says it all. It's called I Can Smell That Funky Music.
Yikes.
Been in this big city, you know, long enough. Hustling all day, working all night, and things are getting mighty rough.
That's keeping it real. You can smell that funky music. Eric Mercury on that track. All right, then. See what we can do here with the time that we got left. I wanted to play one more track by Little Milton. Little Milton was one of like a darling on Chess Records for a while, until old man Chess had passed away, and he felt that things weren't going to be quite the same for him at that label at that point. So he decided to head south, see what he could do. ended up recording this song with what was pretty much left of the MG's rhythm section, Al Jackson and Duck Dunn. Assisted him on this track, and then ended up getting a top 10 R&B hit.
Impressive.
For Little Milton. It's called That's What Love Will Make You Do. Right then, that about wraps it up this week. We'll be back next week as we start to cover phase three of the Stax story at totally independent Stax Records. Meanwhile, we'll leave you with this track by Johnny Taylor, standing in for Jody. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
I don't need nobody.
My tree.
Shaking my tree. Save all your loving, baby. Save it just for me. You kiss me, but the feeling just ain't there. No, no. You're saving the real thing for Jody, and you're using me just for a spell.